And thank you, guest announcer Ian Button. Having a wonderful time. Ian will be with us tonight in just about 3 hours as he fills in for Art Bell. And we'll tell you what he'll be talking about a little bit later on. Well, the last hour, a fascinating conversation with Charles Ostman, the topic singularity, artificial intelligence, and the merging of the organic with the technical. And we kind of not full circle, but now kind of go back to the way it all began, the cognitive intelligence. And our guest, Neil Slade, who is an author of books on brain and behavior science, teacher, musical composer, seasoned concert performer, and artist. And I'll tell you a little bit more about him coming up here in just a moment. And we'll also learn how to, click. We'll tell you what that's all about, too, how to click your brain forward and reach its fullest potential, or at least attempt to, here on Coast to Coast Live. I'm Ross Mitchell in for Ian Punnett. This is Coast to Coast Live on Premier Radio Networks. I'm Ross Mitchell in for Ian Punnett this evening. And joining us now for the next 3 hours, Neil Slade, an author of books on brain and behavior science. Neil has taught music, art, and brain and behavior self-control. We'll find out exactly what that is for 30 years, privately and in the public school system and beyond his classroom instruction. Has taught an estimated 25,000 individual music and art lessons to students ages 6 through 66. He was an assistant to brain and behavioral researcher TDA Lingo. And 11 years at Colorado's Dormant Brain Research and Development Lab. We'll find out why they call it that. Established by Lingo in 1957. And for several years, Mr. Slade was employed full-time to create and present therapeutic creativity music and art workshops at many of Colorado's major psychiatric and medical treatment centers. And in an unprecedented original mind music program, Neil Slade was employed by the principal of a Denver public elementary school to teach all 600 students and their teachers how to self-activate advanced levels of creativity, intelligence, and cooperative trust behavior by learning brain basics. And hopefully, Mr. Slade will teach us some brain basics on this program in before it's all said and done. The program ended with teachers singing to their students and students dancing in the classroom, and a pandemonium broke out. Neil is the author of 5 books on brain and behavior science and self-control. Publishes 20 brain music and audiobook CDs. He's got a feature film to his credit, The Amazing Brain Adventure. His book, The Frontal Lobe Supercharge, has been additionally translated into German, Chinese, and currently is in the process of being translated into Norwegian. Please welcome to the program Neil Slade. Mr. Slade, thanks for joining us on Coast to Coast Live. We are well. How about yourself, sir?
I'm doing great. You have that million-dollar voice, I'll tell you.
Well, only if you account for inflation, I suppose. Meanwhile, of course, so many people are familiar with you, Neil, talking about the click forward of the amygdala.
Sure.
And I know you've been a guest on this program before. Let's talk about that in a little bit greater detail. First of all, what is the amygdala? And I understand that we have one on the right side and one on the left side of the brain. Is that correct?
Right. It's a little protuberance. It's a suborgan of the brain, and it's kind of located in the middle of our brain. If you go about an inch inside each temple, kind of midway between the back of the eye and the inner ear, in that general region of the brain. It's about the size of the tip of your thumb. And the name amygdala really comes from the Greek word meaning nut or almond. And
does that have to do when your amygdala is malfunctioning and they say you're nuts?
Well,
never mind. I shouldn't have gone there.
That's pretty good.
All right, now is there a difference between the left amygdala and the right amygdala as far as function?
No, generally it's basically the same. The only difference would be that if they work independently. So, for example, your right amygdala could be circuiting energy forward to the front part of your brain, whereas the left amygdala could be circuiting energy to the back part and disconnecting the left hemisphere. A good example of that might be Mozart, who was very adept at musical types of creations, but yet he couldn't keep track of his finances. See, music being a more predominantly right hemisphere, nonverbal process, but mathematics and keeping your checkbook straight, That's linear left brain, you see?
Now, does this have any connection to what we call the idiot savant when they're extremely musical, but in other areas of life can't function at all?
That's very...
Does the amygdala come into play there?
I don't think so, because that type of behavior is very little understood, and people who have that type of ability that you're talking about, they can't dress themselves, they can't do very, very rudimentary types of processes that most of us can. So it goes far beyond just simple left brain dysfunction. It's almost inconceivable brain dysfunction in these types of individuals. But yes,
right, well, the amygdala is something totally new to me. Obviously, you've been researching it for quite some time and studying with it. And your contention is that we can click our amygdala forward, correct?
Yes, and that's when the
can you lead us through that collectively tonight and see if we can all learn how to do that?
Oh, I'm sure we can. Sure.
All right.
The court, it's a well-known established fact that you can use your higher brain to take control over lower brain functions. In other words, you can use the smart part of your brain to overcome the limitations of the reptilian or primal parts of your brain. And that's really a key issue that we need to address on many social levels and political levels and so forth.
Now, it's been said that the human brain, that we only use about 10% of our neurological capacity.
Sure.
Is that a myth, or do you have some empirical evidence to back that up?
There's a lot of truth to that. It's not literally true because, for example, we make a lot of use of brain scan technology these days. There are magnetic brain scans. There are chemical brain scans that we use, and they really let us take a picture of the brain at work. Now, what we see is we see activity happening all over the brain at any given one at any given time, but we can also see great fluctuations in activity in certain regions of the brain. So, for example, if you are doing some type of musical activity, for example, you'll see a great increase in brain activity in the prefrontal cortex, in the front part of the brain. And so you'll see a dramatic increase of usage. Well, when that's not happening, obviously that part of the brain is much more dormant. So what I say to people is that we have infinite brain potential, okay? We, mm-hmm. Someone like Sir John Eccles, who was the Nobel laureate, he came to Colorado and gave a lecture, and he said, in his own words, he said, for anyone to say that we use only 10% of our brain, no percentage is accurate because the brain has infinite potential. So if someone says, well, we only use 10% of our brain, well, in a way, that's very true. We only use a fraction of what is possible. We don't know.
Or what is necessary for the task at hand, I guess, right?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, how many times have you...
For example, I'm probably not filling my lungs to their 100% at the moment, and if I were to start running, then I would be using a greater percentage of my lung capacity.
Oh, absolutely.
Is that a good analogy?
That's a good analogy. Or say lifting weights, okay? Any time of the day we're not using 100%. Just because we're walking and doing daily activities, that doesn't tell us how much we are capable of lifting with our musculature, and also if we work out, if we do spend a lot of time exercising, we can increase the amount of weight that we can lift over a period of time. So in the same way, the muscle, the brain responds to demands in exactly the same way as our musculature. So there are some times when our brain is much more at rest, and there are other times when our brain is much more active.
I suppose you could call it neurological displacement on demand,
yeah,
in a sense.
That's a good way of putting it. That's a very
all right. Now, what are the main big structures or the compartments that make up the human brain? We've got the frontal lobes. We've touched on the amygdala, and what all comes together to make up this thing we call the brain?
Well, the brain evolved over many millions of years, and one very well accepted model of the brain. A simplified way of looking at the brain was developed by a fellow named Dr. Paul McLean. And he worked at NIM, and he became the director of the Laboratory for Brain Evolution and Behavior. And
now, what is NIM, Neil? What is NIM?
National Institute of Mental Health.
Okay.
Okay, everyone's heard of the secret of NIM, you know, the story of the mice who escaped from there. But anyway, Dr. McLean developed a model of the brain that he called the triune brain. And he said the human brain, if you look at the actual physical structure, appears to be three brains in one. You have a central core that he called the reptile brain, okay? And this is surrounded by a midbrain that he called the mammal brain. And then there's another layer that goes around both the reptile brain and the mammal brain called the primate brain. And that's the big wrinkly part that we see when we see a brain in a laboratory or in a jar, you know, in movies. And each of these different parts of the brain have their own very kind of specific function. The reptile brain, for example, computes self-defense and counterattack behaviors, reactive behaviors that come into play when we feel as though we are threatened and need to protect ourselves. The mammal brain layer that goes over that adds on to those basic primal functions. It adds on basic social behaviors and emotions and nurturing types of behaviors, okay? And then we've got this big 1-inch thick layer of gray matter and white matter around that, and that adds on much more sophisticated and developed brain processes that come into play when we do math and when we do language and very fine motor control. Now, the very front part of the primate brain, and this is the part right behind your forehead, right above your eyebrows. This is called the frontal lobes. And that's the most advanced part of your primate brain. And now it allows us to understand cause and effect. That's where we compute concepts of time. That's where our imagination and abstract thinking comes into play. Advanced levels of cooperative types of processes. So we have these three very independent layers, the reptile brain, the mammal brain, and the frontal lobes. And right in the middle, right between the reptile brain and the frontal lobes, are these amygdala master click switches. And they very much control how much energy is spent and used in the reptile brain and whether or not further energy goes forward into the frontal lobes to compute more advanced, creative, cooperative, imaginative, logical types of processes.
Now, does that happen when when the amygdala perceives the reptilian brain as being on overload or has done as much as it can?
Well,
how does it know when to send those signals on further?
Well, it has to do with conditioning and when threats are perceived. For example, if you're walking down a mountain trail and you see a rattlesnake in the middle of the trail, your amygdala picks up on that and it immediately clicks backward, and then you go into fight or flight response. You don't even have to think. You don't even have to, compute what you're going to do next. You automatically click backwards into flight or fight. Okay? Now, the cortex, the frontal lobes and the reptile brain, there's two things that can happen at that point. Okay? You can either stay clicked backwards or you can use your frontal lobes to allow the energy to move forward. You can consciously use intellect and intelligence to move the energy forward, at which point you come up with more advanced solutions other than running or fighting with the snake. Follow?
I do. Although, you know, you hear the expression, he was overcome by fear and literally frozen. People freeze sometimes. So
absolutely.
Guess fear
that's
can
when
work.
The amygdala is clicked back and the cortex is just shut down. Now, the interesting thing is you can teach yourself how to click forward into more advanced processes, one just through planning and then through conditioning. So let's say, for example, you're going to go, and I'll give you an example of this. Let's say you go to Rocky Mountain National Park, okay? And two people, one stops at the ranger station before they go on the hike, and the other one just goes on the trail immediately from the car. Okay, now, both people encounter mountain lions on the trail in the park. Now, the first person who went directly from the car didn't really make any plans, didn't add any data to what he, you know, what might happen. So he sees the cougar, and he clicks backwards into his amygdala, and he panics, and he runs away as fast as he can. He just clicks into fight or flight, and he runs as fast as he can away from the cougar. Well, what happens? The cougar
chases, most likely.
The cougar what?
Chases him most likely,
exactly.
I would think.
Exactly. The cougar perceives him as prey, and he catches the hiker, and the hiker is now that cougar's lunch that day, okay? But hiker number two, he stopped at the ranger station, and he clicked forward, and he saw a bunch of pamphlets, and there was one pamphlet that said, Safety in the Park, and he opened it up, and he read the description of what you do when you see a cougar. And it says, okay, you should raise your hands above your head, make yourself as big as possible, perhaps open up your jacket, make yourself look big, and make lots of noise and wave your hands. And this will, the effect that this will have is the cougar will see you not as prey. Oh, and it also said, don't run away, just stand your ground, okay? And the cougar will then, rather than eat you for lunch, will realize, oh, well, that's not a deer. This is something I don't understand, and it's bigger than me. I better go away.
So right, the cougar's amygdala will click back, too, I
that's
guess.
Right. So when hiker number two is on the trail and he sees a cougar, suddenly he says, okay, let's see. I just read instructions, and I need to follow those instructions and go through step one, two. I'm going to open up my jacket and wave. And he uses his higher intelligence. And the cougar runs away, and he survives that encounter. So this.
Now, what about you're overcome with so much fear that you don't click forward and you don't remember that which you just read in the pamphlet. In other words, the chemicals that create that fear response take over your reasoning. Is that a problem?
Well, that is a problem, but what
and you
changes,
panic.
What changes that is anticipation of a known threat. For example, if you practice something, when that occasion arises, you are much more capable and much more likely to use those advanced problem solution alternatives to you. If you just ignore or disregard that any such thing can happen to you, then you're more likely to become the victim. And that's where the frontal lobes come into play, because the frontal lobes can anticipate future events. They calculate abstract scenarios. They can calculate what will happen down the timeline. So if you use your frontal lobes to anticipate and calculate future events, then your ability to overcome those great, those great moments where you have a lot of fear is much more greatly enhanced. It's not so much what happens at the moment, it happens at preparation. If you prepare yourself, you know, a Boy Scout is always prepared. That's the key, is that you use your frontal lobes and your advanced intelligence before something occurs. And that's
so we can be preconditioned to handle something.
That's
is
right.
What you're saying.
Absolutely. That's why.
Now, and as I understand it, there have been studies that, for example, rats that were conditioned to a frightening or painful situation developed a more advanced response to it. It wasn't just a fear or flight situation, right?
You
get to learn how far you can go with something.
Yes. Yes. So it all really depends on how, you know, you're conditioned, how you're prepared, and so on and so forth.
Is
Very
that why
often,
some people?
I mean, reality is what you expect it to be. So very often if you anticipate events before you get there, you're much more able to deal with those type of situations and much less likely to be frozen by reptilian brain fear.
Is it safe to say that we, in a sense, create our own reality?
Oh, I think that's very true. You have to ask the question, first and foremost, what is reality?
And what does the brain perceive as real?
Well, interestingly enough, we see the world right side up. When we look out with our eyes and we see a tree, and at the bottom of the tree is the root, and at the top of the tree are the leaves and the branches. So we just assume that's what's out there. But the funny thing is, that version of visual reality is created in our brain. Because if you look at the optics of the eyeball, the image of the tree planted in the earth actually enters and is projected on the back of the retina upside down. And our brain, in fact, takes the reality of that upside-down optical image and puts it right side up.
All right, and we will explore the reality of our brain and, for that matter, personal and collective reality with Neil Slade here on Coast to Coast Live. I'm Ross Mitchell in for Ian Punnett on Premier Radio Networks. And thank you, guest announcer Ian Punnett, whom we'll be with you in, about 2.5 hours or so as Ian fills in for Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM. We are talking brains tonight with Neil Slade. And a short time ago, we were talking about the fear response in the brain. And scientists, as I understand it, Neil, have found that the seed of fear in the brain, proving that one of the most potent human emotions, fear, actually has a chemical basis, which I guess could lead to the possibility that we could make a new generation of drugs that would render man virtually fearless. What do you say to that?
Well, I think the well-known one is alcohol, isn't it? Is it not?
You know, people. Well, no, I said fearless, not stupid.
I'm not hip to the
what's going on in that area.
In terms of the pharmacology of
that. Right.
But they do understand what neurotransmitters are involved, when the amygdala, for example, is circuiting signals back to this more reptilian primitive part of the brain. And there are chemicals that would either enhance or restrict the movement of those neurotransmitters along those neural pathways. And I don't know the specific names of those.
Now, what is
sure
it that makes,
they're getting a good window on that at this point.
Andy, what is it that makes some of us have more courage than others under similar circumstances? For example, I have a bit of a fear of heights, and yet some of the ladder I wouldn't climb, other people go right up there and think twice about it.
Sure. We're all very familiar with those pictures of people on top of the Empire State Building.
Steel workers, et cetera, you bet.
And things like that. I don't know. I would imagine there's genetics comes into place, but I think more importantly, learning and environment plays a big role. And, you know, before the break, we were talking about, you know, what happens when you, find yourself in one of those moments where you're frozen by fear.
And literally.
What I keep in mind is, you know, I mean, there's physical laws of nature, and the physical law of the conservation, I think it's called the conservation of momentum, whereas an object at rest will tend to stay at rest, and an object in motion will try to keep that motion going. And I think the same thing is true on a mental level as well. If a person is used to using advanced types of thinking, uses critical thinking a lot, uses imagination a lot, is anticipating events a lot. If he finds himself in a stressful position, he will have more of a tendency to keep those types of brain mechanisms going. Whereas a person who is not used to using these advanced types of creative and anticipatory processes, they're going to have a much more difficult time using those kinds of processes to get them out of that frozen in fear type of situation.
So a lot of our response has to do with our individual and collective experiences.
Yeah, it has to do with our training, as it were, and our environment and what we've come to expect out of things. And, you know, so often our own perception of reality is what we've come to expect it to be, not necessarily out of what that actual reality is. For example, for I don't know how long doctors thought that ulcers in the stomach were caused by stress, and they treated stomach ulcers. I mean, they treated stomach ulcers by trying to remove stress.
Biofeedback and so forth.
Yeah, well,
finally, and even surgery.
Yeah, well, two Australian doctors won the Nobel Prize because they showed that most ulcers are in fact caused by bacteria infection. And from that point, everything changed, and the treatment of ulcers changed.
Now they're treating them with antibiotics and so forth.
Yeah, that's how they do it now, and now they're very successful in treating ulcers. But for decades, everyone thought it was stress-related, and that's how the treatment was. So the reality of what an ulcer was, how the reality of ulcers changed when new discoveries were made. That applies to so many things across the board of how we perceive history, how we perceive human behavior, just countless examples. Here's a really fun example of how we perceive reality can change depending on our expectation. I don't know if you've heard this, but people say that one day out of the year on the vernal equinox, you can balance an egg on its end. Have you ever heard that?
I have not, and hens have never tried it.
Well, people, and we went to the grocery store earlier this evening, friend and I, and we asked the grocer about that. And I said, you know, I've heard that you can balance an egg on end on the vernal equinox. And the grocer said, yes, that's true. I've tried it on other days, and it couldn't be done. But I got my kids together on the vernal equinox, and that's like, I guess that's the solstice. And he said, we were able to balance the egg on its end. And I thought, wow, that's pretty interesting that would work. So that's what he thought the reality was about balancing an egg. And that's what I thought the reality was. Well, as it turns out, I went home and I Googled it. And I wanted to see if it was possible to balance an egg on its end on this one day of the year. And the website instructed me and says, yes, it is possible. But by the way, it's also possible to balance an egg on its end 365 days of the year.
A lot of reality has to do with expectations then, too.
That's right. And what it pointed out was that people on any other day would give up easily. Okay? And so they would come to the conclusion that it's not possible. But on that one vernal equinox, they would sit there and they would keep trying until they could balance the egg on its end. And hence, they would eventually succeed because it is possible to do that. Okay? So anyone thinking that it's possible on this one day would be much more prone to succeeding at that task because of their expectation. And they would be much more prone to failure on another day because they really didn't expect it to work. Did you follow what I'm getting
Indeed.
At there?
Well, let's talk about the differences between personal and collective reality, or the similarities. First of all, the differences.
Personal and collective realities. Well,
I mean, what do we perceive as real when we're by ourselves versus what we may perceive as real when we're with a large group?
Sure. Well, you know how the term peer pressure. We tend to believe something in groups when a lot of people around us say that something is true.
Kind of like the urban myth phenomenon.
Sure, the urban myth phenomenon. A good example of this would be, collective wisdom would be that Pearl Harbor, for example, was a surprise attack by the Japanese, which brought us into the war. Okay? And most people would say, yeah, that was true, and that's what we read in our history books and so on and so forth. But there are some other people who have studied that particular event and will tell you, well, you know what? That's not quite true, because if you look very carefully into the intelligence gathering apparatus in place before that time, you'll find that many intelligence sources anticipated an attack by the Japanese. And then they'll tell us that, well, many of the newer valuable ships before Pearl Harbor were moved out to sea, and that the older, more obsolete ships were left in the harbor on that day. And if you talk to some radar people, they say, well, you know, radar at that time, it was not as sophisticated as it is now, but it most certainly was capable of detecting a large fleet of Japanese ships not too far from the islands. So, you know, we are very much affected by what, you know, a conventional wisdom might say about an event. And if we talk to certain other individuals who might be more in the know on a topic, we may get a completely different story. So peer pressure plays a very significant role in how we perceive reality and what is true and what is not true. Very often, the information that we decide is true doesn't come from our own personal examination of facts, but rather, well, we read it over here, or we got this information off the TV, or
of course, these days, people just assume because it was on the internet, it must be true.
Yeah, well, the internet, that's also true. That's also true. The internet, you know, there's all kinds of things on the internet. There's all kinds of things on television. There's all kinds. So, our perception is very much colored by the sort of collective, oh, you know, the telephone game, you know, where one person will start with a sentence and they'll tell at a party and they'll tell someone else and that person will tell somebody else and you'll have the story go through. And by the time you get to the 15th person, the story is nothing like.
Indeed. Indeed.
So
it's a good game to play around a campfire.
Yes. We have to ask ourselves how much of that information that we are assuming to be true is the product of group think and group consciousness, or are we really getting it from the horse's mouth?
Indeed. Well, you know, being in the radio business and in the news business, frequently we get telephone calls. Well, you know, the newspaper says something different from what you're reporting.
Sure.
And I often point out to people that it was the newspaper, I believe, that also said Dewey defeats Truman, so I rest my case. And we will continue with our guest Neil Slade and picking his brain tonight on Coast to Coast Live. I'm Ross Mitchell in for Ian Punnett on Premier Radio Networks. This is Coast to Coast Live on Premier Radio Networks. I'm Ross Mitchell in for Ian Punnett and talking with Neil Slade, and we are exploring the brain, and in particular, reality, perception of reality, and fear. And let's get back to fear for just a second, Neil. Where exactly does fear occur in the brain? Is that in the?
Well, fear, first of all, we're talking about the reptile brain and the mammal brain and the
right now. What role does the amygdala play in fear,
well,
though?
The controlling amygdala, fear again is in the mammal brain. And the mammal brain computes emotions in the human brain. And emotions are really feedback that tell us what types of processes and activities will either enhance our survival or will make our survival less. And I'll give you an example of this. Whenever we feel negative emotions, such as boredom, or fear, or apprehension, depression, okay? These are all emotions that are telling us that we are not using all of our brain potential, that we are clicked backwards into reptilian types of brain processes in which our survival is threatened. For example, if we see a fire, we will be scared. And what is happening is the amygdala is clicking backwards. And let's say our hand is near a fire. We'll quickly pull our hand back from the fire through fear. And the fear is generated because we have learned through experience that fire burns.
So, whereas a small child, constantly you have to childproof the house so that they don't touch fire.
Because they haven't learned that fire burns yet. So when an inexperienced infant sees the pretty blue flower on top of the stove, its amygdala has not yet made that memory, created the memory that fire burns. So the little kid will go and try to touch the pretty blue flower on the stove. Okay, so the first time that infant does that, it gets burned and it feels the pain of the fire. And what the amygdala does is it makes a permanent memory inside the brain, a very strong shortcut memory link. And every time that infant sees a blue flower on the stove, it doesn't have to relearn that experience. It instantaneously clicks into that memory. The amygdala automatically connects with that memory of fire equals pain. So when the child grows up, it remembers, all it has to do is see the flame, and the person remembers fire, pain, and you keep your hand out of the fire.
Okay. In other words, I don't have to walk on the hot coals to know that it's going to hurt.
That's right.
At some point. What about fear? Obviously, it plays a significant role in our survival, but what about situations where fear has actually worked against our survival?
Well, okay. I've been really very much studying this whole 9/11 controversy. I found it just, to me, it's like I feel like Sherlock Holmes lately, and I'm looking at all the various ways in which people are interpreting this. So I go back in history, and I ask myself that question. Okay, in history, for example, as a whole social culture, how have we benefited from fear, and how have we not benefited from fear? So I took two good historical events, and we talked about Pearl Harbor earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, Pearl Harbor was something that generated an enormous amount of fear in the eyes of the American public. Up to that point, the Americans were very much in favor of isolationism. We did not want to get involved in the war that was going on in other parts of the world. Well, Pearl Harbor happened, and suddenly all Americans were fearful, and we were then willing to go get ourselves involved in the war. And ultimately, the outcome of that conflict was that we eliminated this fascist threat of Nazism and the imperialist Japanese culture. So that fear generated a positive outcome historically. But then, if you move up in history, we can look at another similar event, and this is the Gulf of Tonkin. Now, historians now have come to understand that that was pretty much a fabrication. But it was used in the same way to try and generate public support.
So we get right back to the perception of reality.
Indeed. That was presented to the public as a way to generate fear, and suddenly we were behind. The public said, okay, it's okay, we'll now go and bring democracy to Vietnam. But the outcome to that conflict was very different. And in the end, it was a terrible thing.
A disaster.
It was a total disaster. Millions of Vietnamese citizens died, tens and tens of thousands of Americans. And in the end, the North Vietnamese just came down and occupied. So, had we not gone, the result would have been the very same. So that's a historical example of when people were motivated by fear, but the outcome was very negative for all concerned. So fear is something that can enhance our survival, but fear is also something that can make it so it's against our survival. And that works both on an individual basis, but it also works on a large cultural basis as well.
Are there any alternatives or cures to experiencing fear, Neil?
Well, sure there are. And that's what we were talking about when we were speaking of the frontal lobes. Now, the frontal lobes are different from the reptile brain because the reptile brain just reacts. It doesn't think. It really only gives you two options, fight or flight. Either you run away or you fight back.
It doesn't consider any alternatives.
You don't, because it's just instantaneous.
Instinct.
Program. But the frontal lobes are that part of your brain that computes creativity,
And we'll talk about computing creativity in just a moment. All right, Neil Slade, our guest. We're exploring the brain on Coast to Coast Live.